Let's Get Crazy.
Let's Get Crazy.
This is Todd Bagley, your host, and your other host is here as well.
Lindsay Bagley.
Nice. I'd love it when you
see,
laugh.
See, I try not to laugh during these things.
That's good. I like that you laugh.
Okay, Lindsay Bagley, live from our dining room.
Gross. That's cool.
What's gross about that?
Nothing's gross about it.
Okay.
So, to start this off, again, this is episode 2. Well, previous episode, we talked about what it was like to be married, trying to figure marriage out. This mentally unhealthy, depressed husband and an awesome wife.
And a, well, completely unaware wife. We can say that too.
Yeah, you were a little naive.
Yeah.
It was great.
It's cool.
So at this point in time, we went all the way up to approximately dental school and we started having kids as well. And so at this point, we just want a bullet point to get to the important year 2018, which actually I think is the main point, the starting point of why we actually do the broadcast.
Yeah, I would say it's the blast off point.
So as far as bullet points to get to there, in 2008, we had graduated from dental school and decided to pursue a pediatric dental residency. For a year, we had moved up to Salt Lake City, Utah to work at a pediatric dental office in that area, and then came back down to Las Vegas in 2009 to start the pediatric dental residency.
Yep.
Anything beyond that?
We left Utah and realized how much we hated cold and snow when we went back. When we moved back here to Vegas, I was pregnant with my third.
That's right. Yes. No. When we moved back, you were pregnant about a year afterwards. Because Caden was born in 2011.
Right before we went. You're right.
That's actually an interesting lead as to...
How did I forget that?
During dental school, you would really wanted to go back to Utah to be with our families.
Yep.
And I did not.
That is true. I really did.
Last episode, we kind of talked about how we didn't fight a lot, just in general. Mm-hmm. That was one fight that we had.
That is true. I wanted to go home. What I thought was home.
To be with, why did you want to go home?
I don't know, honestly. I think I just felt this pull to be by my family because most people I knew did that. Because I didn't actually love Utah weather. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't, I don't think it was the place. It was more the people. And I think that's what I just thought you did, honestly.
It's not uncommon.
Yeah.
Head back to mom and dad.
Well, and once we did, we realized it was pretty chaotic trying to juggle all the family stuff.
Yeah, it wasn't our favorite thing.
No.
But I did not want to go back.
You did not.
On a spiritual point, I had invested a lot of energy at this state trying to figure out, okay, what does God have in store for us? And there was one specific night where I felt like I had a very significant prompting. At some time in the future, be aware of an unexpected opportunity. There were certain things that were associated with this opportunity that I knew that I was going to be looking out for. Within this prompting, I also knew that a necessity to follow Lindsay, let her kind of guide the way. And so during that year in between dental school and residency, that's why we actually ended up in Utah, because of that prompting to follow where Lindsay wanted to go. And that was a good experience.
Yeah.
Now, we loved Utah, but it was a good work opportunity. And we were able to save
money. Yeah, no, that definitely was a good work opportunity. We could save money.
Before going back to residency, and I got some business experience.
It was good.
Yeah. So, 2009, we come back to Las Vegas in residency. About halfway through residency, I start to see certain familiar events that made me think something is coming down the line as far as a work opportunity. Never ever thinking that I wanted to work for myself, mainly because of my lack of energy.
Yeah.
And my ADD-ness.
I mean, the interesting thing is now, can you even imagine working for someone with your personality?
No, they beat me up. So about halfway through the residency, I'm approached by the Dean of Student Affairs at the UNLV School of Dental Medicine. And he said that he wanted to talk with me. And this is somebody that I had known while I had gone through dental school, somebody that I really respected, but I was not the only UNLV graduate in the dental residency program. So I found it interesting that he actually decided to approach me on this. I went to his office a couple hours later, and he said that he wanted me to meet with several orthodontists in the area who were looking to actually open up an office and wanted to know if there was a pediatric dentist that this dean, Dr. Brownstein, thought would be interested in opening a pediatric dental office next to them. I mean, long story short, I decided to, feeling that as far as the prompting of God, if I didn't do that, I would lose any favor that I might have from God on a business point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say you'd lose favor from God, but I think we definitely felt like that was something we needed to pursue.
Yeah. I'm trying to think how exactly I would put it, the word at best.
I don't think you would lose favor from God, but you just knew that you'd had that prompting, that things were coming, that you felt strongly this was a part of it. So you couldn't really not pursue it.
Correct. This was 2011 in Las Vegas. This is shortly after the crash.
Yeah, the crash.
So the idea of opening up a practice at this point in time, it's pretty insane.
Oh yeah, most people thought you were crazy.
Anytime that I mentioned it to any of the professors at school, they were like, that's good luck.
Yeah. Are you sure you want to do it in this environment?
Correct. However, I knew that if I didn't follow that prompting, regardless of whether the business was successful or not successful, if I didn't follow that prompting, then whatever path I took, I would be absent God's assistance. And so at that point in time, it was a no-brainer. I said, as much as I don't want to do this, I have to do this.
Yes, so I do remember having that conversation.
So we started building the office. I graduated in June of 2011. We started building the office like 3 months before that.
Yes.
And it opened in October of 2011.
Just opened its doors. I mean, you didn't buy a practice. You had no patient base.
Yeah.
Just put up a sign. We just remodeled the building and put up a sign. I mean, think about that.
Yeah. Hired a couple of people who really had no dental experience, but who were cool.
Went for the personality, not the skill.
Yes.
And worked out.
Yeah. Yeah. That's insane. I don't know how it worked out. People are nice, I guess. Yeah. They felt pity for me. But
yeah. Oh, they didn't feel pity for you. You're good at what you do.
So we discussed from that point on until 2017, as far as the emotionally, there's nothing outstanding that occurs. We have a fourth child.
Yeah, we're just doing parenthood. We moved into a new house.
Yeah.
Plugging along.
And not that I'm doing awesome mentally. I have my ups and downs. There are points where I have some significant loss of energy. And as far as study time at this point, because I'm not in school, I now have time to actually commit some academic study towards my own physiology. So I do a couple of things.
Yeah.
I took a DNA sequencing test to identify certain weaknesses in my metabolic cycles. In doing that, we identified a few weaknesses. I took some supplements according to those weaknesses that were supposed to help, one being lithium orotate. That was weird. And that actually
helped for a minute.
It was like 3 or 4 weeks.
Had like an awakening, that movie.
It was like,
seriously.
It seriously felt that way.
Yeah.
I feel that way when I have those moments where things just become clear and I feel normal. So, yeah. But it slowly began to dissipate. There definitely was something physiological about it though, because I mean, this is disgusting, but this is necessary to talk about because it's actually part of the process.
Oh my gosh, what?
I had the worst gas. Do you remember that?
I mean,
it was like there was something dead inside of me that the lithium orotate got out.
I probably have blocked that from my memory.
Good.
Oh my gosh, Todd, seriously.
Okay. As I discuss these things, I actually think it's important to talk about the things that are the ugliest so that people will be like, so that people will understand, should they go through a similar process, I might have nasty gas at one point in time.
Yeah, you need to let people know what's.
Hey.
Yeah.
You know, our kids were like, oh my.
Okay, we've spent enough time on the gas. They get it. Moving.
Okay, we'll cut a little bit of that out.
Yes, we will.
Maybe.
Oh my gosh, keep going.
Okay, so there was also an antiviral sequence that I took that was associated with a lot of vitamins.
You were always doing some system of something and taking...
trying something new.
Yes, you were...
I was desperate.
Yeah, but I think you were desperate, but you were also just willing to do it. I don't know if that's a normal... Well, I shouldn't say normal. It always amazed me that you were willing to like research it and try new things constantly. That gets exhausting. When they don't work, you'd try something else. When it didn't work, you'd try something else.
And that makes sense in that if I am trying to support a business and a family, and I want to be the best pediatric dentist that I can be, not even that, but just a good dad, a good friend, a good neighbor, to be able to do that would require me to figure out what was going on.
Yeah, so you had a good motivation.
Yep. So as much as I was tired, if I had energy, I knew that I needed to find something to boost that up. So as to help the other areas of
maximize.
My life. So we hit 2017.
We're just cruising along.
End of 2017. A couple of things that we had been talking about as a family of doing. I'd actually brought on a partner at that point in time. And we were talking about expanding our business to a second location. We were also potentially remodeling our house. It was perfect timing.
It was hideous timing.
So the end of 2017, my partner and I signed a lease. It's probably going to take a couple of months. A bit of stress. We had the funds saved, though, so there wasn't a financial problem there, but it was just, how do we put this all together? And my partner had not opened up a business previously, and so I was the point man on building the business.
So you're juggling lots of things. We've moved into our house. We're remodeling. You're building a second office.
I'm in a bishopric. I'm the second counselor in the bishopric.
And you're busy. We're busy.
Basically means I'm one of the main assistants to a pastor in our congregation. And that takes
time and 10, effort and
15
energy.
Hours. 10, 15 hours a week of my time. Sometimes with my family, sometimes without my family.
Well, and just any extra energy. You didn't really have any time or energy left after church and work and kids.
Yeah. We come home.
Not to say that's not a lot of people feel that.
Yeah. So in 2018, I began to experience some severe panic attacks.
Yes.
Panic attacks unlike anything I'd experienced previously.
Oh, yes. This was totally new.
And obviously with depression or anxiety, there had been moments where I felt like I'm really, really struggling today. I really don't feel like I can manage. But I never felt suicidal. I never felt scared.
I was going to say, I think that's what made me the most nervous is that you yourself had like palpable fear. It was visceral. Like you could see just by looking at you that you were scared.
What physically?
It's hard to explain kind of. Your face would scrunch a bit. I remember that first panic attack, you kind of collapsed in on yourself. Like you'd walked in and your shoulder, you know what I mean? Like you were kind of trying to close in on yourself, not even just during the panic attack, but just, I mean, it was very apparent.
And these panic attacks aren't just 10 minutes and done.
Yeah, no.
It would feel like it went on for days. But I had to describe it, kind of jumping back in history. At one point in time when we were in residency, we had had somebody break into our home at night while we were there. And that was scary, scary moment.
That was very scary.
Just the idea that somebody is right around the corner that could assault you was scary.
Mm-hmm.
Everything turned out all right. Once they realized we were there, he ran out.
Yeah.
But I was traumatized from that for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling like somebody, feeling unsafe, like somebody was just around the corner ready to attack. And that I needed to protect my family.
Well, and I think too, it's just, you had no control. I think that was, would be similar with the anxiety attack. The fear is that you literally, you can't control the situation.
Correct.
Or the narrative or the thought process or even your physical body at times.
I mean, it legitimately felt like I was on edge, ready to be physically attacked at any moment. That's what it felt internally. There were a couple other significant attributes. I could not sleep at all. So that made me even more exhausted.
Yeah.
Because I am high alert. Even when I tried to relax, I couldn't relax. I couldn't sit down and watch a movie because in my mind, all I could think to myself was, there's something wrong with me. I got to do something.
Yeah.
Work towards.
It was an endless loop of panic.
Yeah. Additionally, I was consistently irritable, way more than I had been before. So I'm generally a pretty irritable person.
Did you say you're generally not irritable or you generally are?
What do you think I said?
I couldn't tell.
I'm asking you, what do you think I said?
I think generally you're not super irritable, but you definitely were at this time. You're not like irritable constantly. That's you're not jovial constantly either.
Yeah, because I'm irritable constantly. It's my curse.
Let me re-explain that. You have an easily irritated personality, but you weren't always that irritable with us at home.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm always suppressing it.
I believe that, but I'm just saying that was a huge shift for us at home.
So at this point in time, then it becomes much harder for me to suppress it.
Oh, yes. There was really no suppression.
To the point where it was either scream out loud all the time or just keep my mouth shut all the time.
Yeah, be comatose.
And that's basically where I turned to because I did not want to take it out on my kids. They were stressed enough as it was.
Yeah,
as they, were you.
We were open with our kids. They knew what was going on.
And they were very cautious around me.
They were.
So if I was to blow up on them, it would make them feel even worse.
Totally, because they were really trying to be aware of what was happening and not to cause further issues. So then these panic attacks keep happening.
So I visit with a doctor. The doctor tells me I have treatment-resistant depression. Basically, my medicine stopped working.
Stopped working so fast.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, you got tired, but it was very fast.
And then to combat the panic attacks, it actually placed me on another prescription medication called olanzapine. Awesome. Again, one of these things that, hey, just
this is the one this you is like, worse. Couldn't eat certain cheeses?
No.
Oh, that was a different one.
No.
See, we've been through a lot of medication.
Yeah. No, olanzapine is actually considered, this is a fun word, antipsychotic. I'm on an antipsychotic.
But at that point, you were borderline psychotic, right? You were
just the anxiety.
I could not get out of it.
Correct.
Yeah.
So I have no problem saying that I was at that point.
Yes.
And it was the only thing that could calm me down.
But it would numb you out.
When you say numb, what was that experience for you looking at me numb?
I'm just a shell of a person, almost like. You wouldn't be anxious anymore, which I was grateful for. And I think you could sleep on that one, couldn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I could sleep really well on that.
But it, almost no emotion. So you weren't necessarily anxious, which was good, but almost just like a shell of a person. Like you wondered, like, is there any personality left in there? I mean, you numbed out.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we were grateful because you weren't anxious 24/7.
Yeah, I wasn't pacing around all of the time.
Yeah.
I wasn't going from one thing to the next, just what do I do? What do I do? What do I do?
Yeah. Yeah.
But
it at least gave you relief from the panic. But it definitely like numbed you from everything.
So it created its own problems.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the issues that I have when I was in having the panic attacks was a concern for, would I be able to ever work again?
Yes.
And this would spiral into something to the effect of,
you came home and said, we need to sell the house. You've got to list the house. We need to sell the house.
In my mind, thinking I can't support the family on this level.
You didn't think that you'd be able to pay your mortgage. And so I just remember saying, okay, I can get it listed. Like, I didn't know what else to say. Mm-hmm. Not really thinking that we would, but if it would help relieve stress, I would have.
That's awesome.
But as we're, you know, remodeling. As we're trying to make this house what we want it to be, I was like, oh gosh.
No, first world problems.
I know. If only that was the issue now.
Correct.
Yeah.
So the olanzapine basically had numbed me out. And that creates its own problems, especially if I'm concerned about work and that I do not have the motivation to interact with people.
You don't have any motivation to do much of anything.
Anything.
Yeah.
It's interesting looking back at some of the, looking at some of the ratings while I was on the medication.
Like, you mean like a Yelp?
Like a Yelp.
Okay.
Okay. There's some where people are like, this guy looks like he's dead.
You were dead inside.
I was.
I know.
So
the funny thing is, you were probably open with them about that.
No, I wasn't. Not at
that point. You weren't then?
No, okay. Not at that point in time. Okay. I wasn't even, everything was just minimize. I would go in, hi.
Barely talk to your staff.
There's teeth in here.
Yeah.
This one's got a cavity. All right. Put that in the treatment plan. They'll help set that up for you up front.
Well, your brain couldn't handle it.
Which is sad.
Thanks, patients, for hanging in there.
Yeah.
Through those ratings.
It was sad for the employees.
Yeah.
But they were...
They stuck it out.
They were awesome.
They were.
Jan was awesome.
Oh, yeah. The office manager at the time. Absolutely.
Jan Sievers was like a second mom to me. She still is.
Oh, yeah. She saved our bacon, man. Seriously.
She carried that office.
And Chandler.
As well as Chandler.
On, yeah, he...
My partner.
Was amazing.
So we also had another associate that came on, Travis and I.
Oh, yeah.
And he was great, too. Awesome.
It was all really good to have them on board.
So treatment-wise at this point, in talking with my doctor, he states there are several options with treatment-resistant depression.
Medicines aren't lasting.
Correct.
Yeah, they're all wearing off.
I'm trying different medicines.
I mean, I remember running around to different pharmacies because it's sometimes hard to get these medications, like calling 6 or 7 pharmacies and driving far to finding one. Like, I remember devoting school days when the kids were at school a lot of times thinking, I just got to get them to school and then I've got to call pharmacy. Like, and then you were detoxing, trying something new. It was nasty.
That was nasty. Yeah. That part came at the end of 2018.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I jumped ahead. Sorry.
What we first did was
electric shock.
Shock therapy. ECT. Electroconvulsive therapy.
Yep.
Basically, I went in and got shock therapy on my brain.
Yeah. They throw you into seizures.
Yes.
It's as weird as you think it is. As it sounds.
The way this process went, I had to get approved by 2 doctors to have this treatment, just to say that I was healthy enough to undergo such. They had to do a test on my heart. Everything panned out that I could do these treatments. And the treatments themselves start off three times a week. And they'd gradually move down to like 2 times a week, 1 times a week, every other week. Mm-hmm. So the first 2 weeks, I actually had treatment 3 times each of those weeks.
Yes.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It was about the beginning of that second week that I started feeling great again.
I do want to just mention that became a full-time job too, which I was grateful to do, but I'd have to drive and stay and wait. And because you were under GA. And so every time you had that, you'd come home groggy. And I would get so scared that you were having so much general anesthesia and shocking. You would come home and want to sleep. And a lot of times I had Talmadge, our little one, with me. We would just lay in the bed and watch you to make sure you like had life. You were breathing. Nice. We had construction guys in and out of here. I think they probably wondered what is going on in this house.
Look at this guy. He's coming in like 3 times a week, all hocked up on
something. And you had all this weird gel all over in your hair from nodes being Yes, but it was good when you got a payoff.
So about a week into it, it started to feel normal. I actually started to do things around our home where we had lived at that point in time for 4 years. Started to do things around the house that I had not done in those 4 years that I always wanted to.
Super motivated.
As far as hope goes, I'm super excited.
You were.
Feeling like this is a big payoff.
Yeah.
And about 2 weeks later, we knew that it was not.
It wasn't long lasting. For some it is, but it wasn't going to be for you.
For me, it was not. So we made some
Did meters. Did it dissipate some of the suicidal thoughts, though? Or were you extremely suicidal at this point?
During the time that I was feeling good.
No, pre-ECT. Like
pre-ECT? Pre-ECT, I'm not really suicidal. I'm scared. I'm anxious, scared, about not being able to accomplish life.
So it was post-ECT that you actually became really suicidal.
Having that hope just dashed. Mm-hmm. I remember talking to the bishop in our ward at that point in time. He came over, and he and I have been really good friends because we worked well together in the bishopric. And trying to instill some hope in me, or trying to figure out if I had any hope at that point, and telling him, hope is poison at this point.
Yeah, it decimated you. That little upper, and then the crash beyond was... It's really hard to explain, because you were so extreme and so hopeful, and we'd wanted help for so long.
And where do you go after shock therapy?
I know, shock therapy. I mean, we were going to the mental hospital 3 times a week.
So, yes, I was despondent, and I did not want to try anything... I'd done enough studying on my own to be able to realize there's not many other options to go.
There isn't.
After this.
I mean, ECT is an extreme option. Not always, but in your case it was. You tried so many things before that.
At this point in time, it's like the levels of grief that I had to go through.
I think both of us were.
Admitting that this was something that was possibly going to be around for the rest of my life. This is how I'm possibly going to be for 40 years.
It's not good. It was horrible.
It was horrible. Uh-huh. Coming to that realization, there was some goodness to it and there was some badness to it. And at least at that point in time, I said, okay, this is what it is. And I'm just going to own it. Because clearly, if I believe in God, God is totally okay with me feeling this crappy for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And I remember you saying that to me, and remember you saying, I mean, you're not, it wasn't rude, but in as nice a way possible, just, you're going to have to deal with this. Our lifestyle may change. We may have to sell our house. Possibly you going back to work. Don't ever count on vacation again. Like there was just, I don't want to hang out with people. There was like this laundry list of things that we kind of had to, I mean, I write in my journal about that. Like, we are just down in the bunker and we're not coming out. We're just going to take the artillery, like fire. We're just going to stay here forever.
We're just in survival mode.
Yeah. I mean, I never thought we'd like almost like leave our house again. That sounds crazy, but yeah, we were in the bunker.
As far as that goes, for our church, culturally, when somebody is down and out, oftentimes people will want to visit.
Show up.
Be social. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you're okay. That was the last thing that I wanted.
Yeah, I think that was the last thing you wanted or needed, just because you couldn't even expend the energy to have a conversation.
And people didn't understand.
They didn't.
People could not understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is such a unique situation. They didn't. How many people do you know that have shock therapy, for one, and number two, that are open about it?
Yeah. Well, and we, prior to this crash, super social. We were always planning date nights and going out, and we were pretty social before this.
We were pretty social. I was always resistant to it just because of my
energy. You've never loved being super social, but we were social with the people around us for sure. And so when we just kind of crawled in a hidey hole, I don't think anyone knew what to do. I appreciated people reaching out and visiting, but I knew I had to run interference. So even though I knew it was good for me, I would resist it because I also knew I'd have to run so much interference that it probably wasn't worth it.
So you yourself.
Yeah. Or I was afraid you'd just like be like done talking and walk away, and it leaves me sitting there like, oh, okay, well, guess he's done. I mean, I remember every morning in the shower getting up, going through our day and literally planning. Like I almost envisioned, sounds silly, us like the bubble boy. Like we're in this bubble. I have to create the bubble of things. So what can I seriously minimize? I would go through the whole schedule like, okay, kids have a church activity. I'm going to have to drive to that. And then there was, I think, was Keller playing lacrosse or maybe volleyball at school, thinking, okay, there's no way Todd's going to go to the game. But if he does, I have him come late, leave early, or remember cheer competitions. I'd have to call you. You'd wait in the car almost, come in, just watch Mac leave. So then it's me doing the 7 hour. Like it was, I mean... Well, every day was planning like that.
Well, no point. Like, that's ridiculous. You want to hang out for 7 hours?
I know. I'm just saying.
This, I was watching the other kids at that point.
Oh, yes.
That was not.
It wasn't even just that. But I'm saying I definitely had to like plan out every day.
You did. That must have been exhausting.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe even anticipating, what if somebody comes up and tries to be social with Todd? How do I offset that?
I am telling you, at every moment of every day, I was thinking, how do I bubble boy? And I don't think it was necessarily right all the time. It just was my survival mode. I just was like the lawnmower parent, but for my husband.
Well, if you didn't, I legitimately would lose it on somebody, but I would just... Yeah.
Even with the kids, I kept them not away from you, but pretty...
Hey guys, if there's a problem,
you come to see me. I'll help with homework. I'll get you up in the morning.
There was one thing that I actually, in my mind, I'm like, I have to do this. That was helping Keller
with math.
With his math.
Because you knew I'd blow.
Every single night. That was the one thing that
it was God's tender mercy for me. Seriously. Was helping Keller with math.
So I would come home from work. I would sit in a certain spot on our couch. I would pull my hoodie over my head and tighten it.
Oh, my gosh.
Don't you have a picture of this?
Yes, with just your eyeballs peeping out. And you were freezing.
And I was freezing. So I would sit there until the point where Keller was ready to do his math. And then I would get up, grab my own scratch piece of paper, because I knew that at this point in time with his math... He and I were going to do it together, and I'd be writing out my own equations so that we could compare. And that would take
math homework. Oh, PTSD.
Oh, man. 2 hours.
Oh, yeah.
But that was the one thing that I knew that I needed to do, and I was proud of myself for it.
Oh, I was so grateful for it. As trivial or as minimal as it sounds, I was so grateful for it, truly.
I remember my...
Because one, I'm math is not my strong suit. Two, Keller's personalities and I then, it was hard. Our two personalities clicking, and looking back, I had put a lot of responsibility on him. He was taking on like a fatherly role in the house. He was having to pick up more responsibility and, you know what I mean?
Take care of his brothers and sisters.
Yeah, so math, me and him going at it and math was not going to be helpful.
It's 2018. He's 12.
Mm-hmm. He took on a lot willingly, never complained. Our kids actually
did really well.
They did really good. We didn't shield them from anything, though. They knew what was going on.
They went to the hospital for ECT treatments.
I made them go with me, each of them at least once, because I, one, wanted to have them see you, what you were willing to do. And two, I wanted them to see the other patients in the facility. It was traumatizing for all of us.
Why did you want them to see those patients?
I had some really interesting experience because these patients were typically ones that had gotten picked up off the street by the police officers, and they bring into this facility to check in. Not all of them. But I almost felt like a kinship with them. And I always felt so sad. Like, why don't you have someone in this waiting room with you? Like, where is someone that you know? How come you don't have anyone here? So I almost felt like our kids needed to realize, one, what they actually had, And two, I just wanted them to see, I don't know if it was the suffering or the crazy, because there were some people in there that did some genuinely crazy things in the waiting room, waiting to be admitted. I mean, we were just in the waiting room. Police officers are bringing in patients.
Crazy, but real.
Totally. And when I say crazy, I actually, in my own mind, you say crazy and the world has a really negative connotation to that. So I can see that. I didn't feel like a negative or like a I'm better than you scenario. I genuinely felt like this crazy is so sad. Like, I didn't think you were any different than them.
Yes.
I didn't. I did not think like...
Todd is 2 weeks away from...
Yes, Todd is 2 weeks away from having no underwear on, bending over this suitcase and packing and unpacking and packing and unpacking and packing and rolling it up in plastic bags in a suitcase, out of suitcase. Like, this was one of the patients there over and over and over. And me being like, one, this poor sweet woman needs underwear and someone to like know she is alive. Yeah, I did not think you were any different than them.
I did not feel any.
I felt kindred spirits. And I wanted our kids to see that there are lots of people out there having a hard go.
It's interesting because at the end of our journey, there was very much this appreciation for suffering, mm-hmm. which we obviously get to. That's the big payoff in the end. But it was almost as if you had a glimpse of that and wanted our kids to see something of that fact of people suffering in a very unique way.
Oh, yes.
So that they could appreciate that, knowing that there is a loving God, that this loving God is okay with these people having an experience like that.
Oh, yes.
And that was something that we, as far as the okayness of suffering, of hardship.
It took a while to get to that mind frame.
But that was actually a very intense conversation that you and I had. By intense, like, do you really know what you're saying? Mm-hmm. Do we really believe what we believe?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just didn't want to hide stuff from our kids. I didn't want them to think everything was okay and normal, because it really generally wasn't. I realize sometimes you don't necessarily expose kids to everything, right? But I mean, I do remember people mentioning, we'll watch the kids. You don't want to really expose them. And I'm like, no, I do want to show them. And I didn't take them every time, mainly because it was exhausting for me to entertain them in the waiting room. Each one of our kids I made go with us, and they were scared. They walked in and they were scared. It's not like a nice facility. Yeah, they were scared at where we had to take you, and they were nervous seeing the other patients. Anyway, we spent a lot of time on that. I'm sorry.
I think that's important because it points to the fact that it was a revelation for us to see how real this was on a completely different level.
Yeah.
While we're also in the middle of the same thing.
Yeah. So we finished ECT.
Also important to mention, at this point in time, a family, not that we knew, but who were good friends with a lot of our good friends, had experienced a suicide.
Yes. That scared me. There were two people we knew that had experienced suicide.
Correct. The second was about a year later. Mm-hmm. This first one, though, was right in the middle of realizing that ECT is not working. Mm-hmm. When I'm hitting that very low point.
Yeah.
And I think, was it Denise that called you? Denise Chipman?
Yes.
And yeah. So I just wanted to let you know.
Yeah.
This family, the dad had committed suicide. Great, awesome family, great guy. Mm-hmm. Not everybody knew that he had had some emotional difficulties, but it then brought about questions for us. What is expected from us? Because at this point in time, I'm really starting to go through my mind, I don't want to feel like this for 4 years.
We kind of just submitted to the fact that you were going to feel like that forever. Until death, honestly. We both thought that.
Yeah. So at one point in time, our discussion went something to the effect of, this may happen. This may be your life. Yep. And how do you console yourself, Lindsay? I would ask you, like, are you okay with that?
No, I was not.
What was your response as far as, like, what consoled you?
Exactly. I mean, obviously I wasn't okay with the thoughts of suicide, but I also realized that was a possibility. You were extremely suicide. I mean, I was tracking your phone everywhere. And if I couldn't get a hold of you during the day, that was always my first thought. Oh, he has ended his suffering.
And that would have been rare because it was usually, I was either at home or is at work.
At work. But I would get nervous even at work if you didn't answer the phone when I called. But I just kept getting the feeling that it was going to be okay, but I didn't know what okay was.
And as part of this unique discussion that we have, we realized that if it happens, my statement to you was, I'm at the point where I'm beginning to realize that God is okay with me feeling this way. This is not a matter of me not following God's commandments. It's not a matter of I don't deserve to have his spirit with me or to feel happy. But that for some reason, he legitimately is okay with me having this experience.
Suffering.
And if he's okay with me having this experience, how far does that go? To the point where then I justified in my mind, and there's way more that goes to it than just what I'm stating here, but that if it happens, he's okay with it. On the idea that there are certain times that God intervenes because there are certain outcomes that he's not okay with.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that then, thinking his non-intervention then indicates that he is okay with a certain event occurring in his plan.
Mm-hmm.
So I stated to you, whatever happens is okay. Realizing that, and I think that was a big like moment for you, because I'd already thought this out clearly.
Yeah.
That okay means anything.
Yeah, I didn't know what it meant.
Were you scared when I said that?
Oh, yeah. I was scared all the time. I mean, yeah, I was scared.
And you didn't, I'm clearly at that point in time when you're hearing that and scared, you're not thinking to yourself, revelation.
Uh-uh.
But for me, that was revelationary.
Yeah.
Did I say that?
Yeah, it wasn't for me.
It actually had fascinated me. Now, it sounds morbid, but the thought process was, if God builds a world, knowing that crazy things will happen in the world, clearly he's okay with us developing massive tools of warfare to be able to operate on each other, knowing from the very beginning that will occur. He is okay with that pain occurring.
Well, and he's okay with free agency.
It's all part of the plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, choice is part of the plan.
And I remember when I started to state that, not just to you, but to other people.
Oh, it threw people.
People were
because they didn't like to think of the idea as God allowing torture.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a hard thing to swallow for most people. I don't know if it still is, but then it was.
And that's what I had equated it to. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm being tortured because what other situation does a person get into where they actually want to die,
mm-hmm.
where they're otherwise healthy?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that made sense to me. Not many people.
Your mind does not work like.
It is almost as if I could not get that revelation or that thought process.
You would not have gotten it without a broken mind.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Broken mind meaning a suffering mind.
Oh, yes.
Because it's not that my mind isn't working correctly at this point in time.
Yeah, sorry. Just a bruised mind.
A bruised mind.
Yeah.
Just knowing that I can think these things through. I just cannot operate emotionally.
Yeah. Yes, that was the interesting thing. You could intellectually come to conclusions, but your emotions were telling you something totally different.
And because I am so irritable, any way to be able to express things, and I have a problem expressing myself anyway, just because of the ADD-ness. I mean, I think that comes across on the podcast that I fumble a bit. I can't get an idea across. It takes me a little while. But that's, in addition to that, at this point, I am an extremely cynical. So if I do, so if I do actually come up with a valid idea, my ability to explain it comes across
so snarky.
Comes across so snarky, and I will use the absolute worst example.
And you lose the message.
I lose the message.
Mm-hmm.
Almost to the point where, like, I don't even want to say it because it just sounds so ridiculous. But
yeah.
I mean, making a legitimate argument that there were certain prophets who were megalomaniacs. meaning that they were able to accomplish some amazing things because they were self-obsessed, which God actually needed them to be. And instead of picking out a more reputable megalomaniac in history, you go to the one, I would automatically go to the one because I was studying a lot of World War II warfare at this point in time as well, just trying to make myself feel better. I automatically choose Hitler. The prophet, this prophet here is like Hitler. And I remember actually telling that to a church member who loved this particular prophet. And then,
oh my gosh.
And then we walked out of that discussion from that house.
I was like, I want to be in that car ride on the way home.
I want to know what that couple is talking about.
They are freaked out.
The Bagleys?
Or they need to fast for us. They were so worried, I'm sure.
Yes, because the way I was saying it.
The presentation was so.
It sounded like I had lost my testimony.
Yes.
Everything good.
Yes, I knew you had not, because I knew you actually were fortified more, because you had submitted to God at that point. Like you said, you do need to touch on that. Mm-hmm. We kind of were jumping all over, but you were having a hard time communicating with other people. But I knew you actually were operating on a faith totally different than you'd ever had before. And you weren't feeling any good feelings doing it. So I knew you were like your foundation wasn't God, because you were doing it with no perk.
Yeah, there was no motivation for me to do it.
So when you would tell stories like that, it would make people wonder, oh my gosh, this guy is losing it. He's going to take his life. He hates the prophets. He hates God. I knew, oh no, he's just trying to find weirdos like himself that stick with the church, stick with God.
Yeah. I'm trying to find out why.
Yes. Yes, but other people can understand that, and you were having a hard time conveying that.
Yes.
So this was all during still ECT.
And they still do. We should make that point out.
Oh, yes.
So if you're listening to this and you're hearing this, like,
I would say the majority of people still think we're weird or have like an interesting take on church. And Yeah.
People begin to flinch a little bit when I raise my hand in church meetings.
Oh, yes.
It's funny.
Yeah. So wrap up ECT. So we finish ECT. It wears off. You become extremely suicidal.
Correct.
We are at that point kind of, I don't want to say locked down because I hate that word, but we were in the bunker.
Correct.
We weren't.
We were locked down 2 years before everybody else was in lockdown.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Then we start trying different medications, or then did you do ketamine?
So we tried ketamine about a month after we stopped with ECT.
So another.
So ketamine being an IV treatment, ketamine being also a.
Which, side note here, I really wish there was better options and more affordable options for the average citizen or average person.
Who's struggling with these things?
Yes, to get help. I mean, these are mostly out of pocket scenarios. You have to go searching for them. Like, this is not, these are not easy things to
dial in,
to dial in, especially to afford to. I mean, honestly, that's just the raw truth.
It's just not readily available to the normal person.
We were blessed beyond measure that Chandler was running the business and we were able to afford these things. Genuinely, truly, that was a mercy from heaven.
On that point, I think that is an excellent point to make, that Chandler and Karen Heyer were seriously angels to us.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
A year and a half before we anticipated that we needed them.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing ketamine treatments. It's basically an IV treatment that puts this medicine in your brain that can...
Well, it's a party drug on some level.
Yes.
Not in this context, but...
I believe I went through ketamine in 7 sessions, and...
That was another thing I had to drive you stay, because you were under kind of anesthesia a little bit.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as ketamine treatment went, very, very interesting. It's like an out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
As far as...
Well, out-of-body because it provides relief.
It does provide the relief. Yeah. As far as relief that I had, it actually, it didn't make me happy. It did take away my desire to be suicidal.
Yeah.
Significantly, which was good.
Yeah.
During the time frame that you're actually receiving the treatment, in my own brain, I could not grasp onto reality. There was occasionally thoughts that would come through like, am I actually alive or do I exist? Am I?
Well, and just to set it up, they bring you back, they put you in a room, a quiet room. They're playing like soft, quiet music. They put a sleeping mask over you and it's pretty dark in there.
Yes.
So you're, they're, yeah.
You're also in there with me.
I'm in there every time.
Just to be able to help soothe me through, because some people find it.
Some people get really scared, or it like brings up more trauma that manifests, or they cry and get emotional. They don't like you to be alone in there because you're already kind of frightened because you're disconnected kind of from your reality, your body.
Yes.
So I remember the doctor telling me that, like having me sit there and just saying, some people get really scared. Some people cry, angry. You didn't do any of those things though. You cried once. The first one, you were very fidgety.
So as far as my own experience in while underneath ketamine, I got to state this just so I get it on record. If anybody has seen the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey.
I haven't seen that
I know
movie.
You've not.
You Continue would, Space
it's
Odyssey.
One, it's one you would absolutely love.
Oh, probably not.
Yeah, you would not. I would not watch
okay,
that.
Okay, Space Odyssey.
There's this moment where this astronaut is going through some type of wormhole. I forget exactly what it is, but it's very colorful yet wavy. And I remember actually watching this after having gone through this ketamine treatment and thinking to myself, visually, that's exactly what I would see when I was on ketamine, except for instead of it being colorful, it was very gray and black tones. Just smoky, but I don't know.
Did you feel like you were flying?
A little bit.
Or just?
Just not in a stable location.
You were fidgety.
But there were a couple of things that I could grasp onto rarely mm-hmm. that would make things feel somewhat normal. I think you were in there. So I started stating our kids' names.
Oh, yes. There was one time that you said for like a straight hour, because they usually were like an hour treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you just kept saying Keller, McKay, Caden, Talmadge on the same rhythm mm-hmm. for like an hour. And I pulled the doctor in at one point and just said, he will not stop saying these over and over. And he said, it actually is common that a lot of times when they want to feel a connection, like if you were kind of like floating out there in this ketamine, that they will kind of loop on a family member.
Trying to find something to associate.
Yes, it wasn't uncommon for you to say, though he did say, it is kind of uncommon that they do it the entire hour and you were...
It's interesting that you said it was rhythmic. I do
it
actually.
It was very rhythmic.
Almost like it was a chant. Chant.
Boom.
Chant. Yeah. Chant.
Keller. McKay. Kate. Yes. I can hear it like it was yesterday.
Keller. McKay. King.
And there were times when you could tell the ketamine maybe had upped a little bit, because I don't think it was potent the entire, that you would slur a little bit, but still the same beat. Constantly, even if it was like Keller, McKay, like you still.
When you're on ketamine, you actually can still hear.
Yeah, you're not asleep.
Not asleep. You're like 5 seconds behind everything. So the doctor would come in and say, how you feeling, Todd?
Yeah.
And there would, and you can feel it in your brain that you're slow. 5 seconds go by. How you feeling, Todd? I'm okay.
Yeah. And he told me I wasn't supposed to talk to you very often, but there were times when you were either fidgety or you kept saying our kids' names that I would say that. Are you okay? And yeah, the response was very delayed. Like I could see in
I'm
your
okay.
mannerisms that you could hear me, but yeah, your response was very delayed.
Were you ever tempted to like chat with me about stuff?
No. Well, for one thing, if the truth be told with ketamine, it was a reprieve for me too, because I sat in a quiet room listening to music. I oftentimes brought a book.
Dude, they should have given you some drugs.
I know. I oftentimes brought a book, and it was honestly, when you had ketamine, it was kind of my only hour of quiet that I wasn't, like I said, the bubble. I wasn't shielding.
Good.
Yeah. So it wasn't horrible. It was actually a good reprieve for me.
So after about 7 treatments, it wasn't making any significant difference.
Except you weren't suicidal.
I was not suicidal.
That was a big difference.
So once we stopped ketamine, and again, I'm still just researching different things that I could do.
Whole time you're never stopped researching, taking blood, changing supplements.
I'm not taking blood just yet, but I get to a point where I'm like, okay, I've got to do this deep dive. And my body's just probably all toxicked out. I've been on meds for
it was so
25 years. And because I was well informed, and when I would go on and talk with my doctor, I knew what I was talking about.
And you could read your labs and you understood the chemistry. And
when I put up the option of coming off of my meds, I mean, there was a little resistance. You're sure you want to do that? Mm-hmm. But I think we had established at this point in time our willingness and my ability to fight through the ugliness.
Well, and you knew chemically what was going to happen.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we had planned out certain things that, like, we would be around other people, our family during this time frame as things were kind of kicking in, mm-hmm. so that you also would have some help.
Yeah. And we hadn't had people come stay with us almost for at least a year. And I mean, we always had people around us. That's what I mean. We were social. We also had visitors like every other weekend at our house, which was awesome. But we kind of cut everybody off. So, but yeah, this was partially like we planned to have. Didn't my parents come? My
parents came. We went up to my parents' cabin with my parents. And then we also went to visit your sister in Reno.
Oh, yeah. That was horrible. Not visiting my sister, just you. That trip was bad.
So, but
for you.
I am detoxing at this point.
They were all very granted so much grace too, by the way.
Yes. And I'm doing that smartly. I'm tapering off. I'm not going cold turkey so that I don't have the withdrawal effects.
Very planned and calculated.
But I mean, it had been 20 years since I'd tried to go off these types of meds. Mm-hmm. And
detox wasn't pretty.
It was tough. Not tough the effect if I had gone off of it cold turkey, but tough on the point that what would happen, I would just become completely tearful. I would cry.
Oh, yes, you would cry a lot.
Anything. We would go to church. And as much as church was the worst couple hours of my week, I would sit in there and just cry. I could not control myself.
Yeah.
It's.
I think it was trauma.
There's something biochemical, I'm sure, about it.
Come off everything.
Come off everything. And then I start taking blood samples. I found this new regime that I was looking at where I was regimen, not regime.
I don't like regime. Who are you joining?
Please. I start my own thing. I was starting this new regimen where I was going to check my blood labs. And at this point in time, I was working with my general physician and my psychiatrist, and neither of them wanted to take the labs, and the psychiatrist would say, hey, this is something that you're...
They were all just passing the buck to the next person. And genuinely, they probably didn't really know...
They didn't.
How to even do what you wanted them to do.
Correct.
Not in a rude way. They just...
Because...
You were literally charting your own course. This was not something they were trained in.
So... For me to have them take the labs, that then creates a liability for them,
yep.
which they didn't want to be involved in. So I ended up just paying out of pocket, taking my own labs, submitting yep. them to some place in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And it would take
getting
readings back and then making adjustments on supplements that I had started to take to be able
you
to
assist.
You
were a mad scientist, dude. Seriously. The amount of things that would cycle through your medicine cabinet. I remember you showing me these papers and these cycles, and this isn't firing this. And I was just like, this is crazy.
In some weird way, it got my brain excited.
I was just going to say, though, it did give you something to... Not that you weren't passionate about it. I wouldn't say you were passionate about it, like super excited, but you definitely... Something kicked in your brain that it was ready. It was ready to take that on.
I also need to mention that I had reluctantly had never gone to a therapist for my, just myself.
The therapist was so helpful.
I went in and was able to talk with her. As reluctant as I was at first, it was good. And she had come up with the idea that okay, you have found over the past couple of years, several of these DNA sequencing supplements that have helped a little bit. Why don't you try them all in combination? And that kind of threw me into this. Okay, I'm taking my labs. I'm trying these additional supplements. Now that my body is detoxed off of the meds for quite some time, this may be beneficial to just replenish everything.
Yeah. I will say, just interject really fast too, therapy was so helpful for me too. I only did like one session with her by myself, but I mean, it helped you and I, because I was dealing with the daily stuff and then you would tell me dark thoughts, which I was so grateful that you were always open with me about things, but I didn't know sometimes how to respond and where to push you and where not to push you. And I was grateful to have someone else to hear you.
And it was good in that there were certain things that even if I felt open about sharing them with you,
wouldn't have been helpful.
Yeah. So I needed somebody that I could actually share those things with.
Yes.
That was just a sounding board.
Yeah.
So that I could get it off my chest and they could bounce those ideas back and say, okay, you're considering this or you're considering this.
Yes. Therapists are amazing. Everyone should go.
Yes. That then kicked in, and this was about the beginning of 2019. This really gradual recovery of not of just
2 years.
When I say recovery, not meaning like, oh my gosh, I feel great.
Oh
again.
Yeah. No, it was very gradual.
It was again, just this, okay. I think I'm going to feel like crap for the rest of my life. I'm okay with that. What do I learn from this?
That was the shift when you realized, okay, God is okay with this for our family, or he would intervene. And then you tried to find purpose in it, I think is where the shift came. On top of still clinically and medically and...
While I'm still working at it.
Yes.
That's what you're saying. Yes.
Yeah. You're still doing the medical side of things, but also like, okay, how is this? What is the meaning of this? Why is this happening?
Yeah, that's a good point. And that I'd not given up on the medical aspects.
No, you still haven't.
I always had, as much as I had said hope was poison, I had always had an adequate amount to be able to continue pushing there.
To continue taking labs and...
But at this point in time, having gone to a really dark place and still feeling like I had... Realizing that God actually had an intent for me to learn something there. And that was a big switch.
Mm-hmm.
That was also... And I think you would term this more cognitive behavioral therapy, where basically you're talking to yourself through things. And again, just to restate, we were opening up this other office. And in September of 2018, we had opened. But when you're first open, you don't always have a ton of patients. So I would sit there for several hours each day. And in my own mental filth.
Stew, we called it. It's
going,
stew in it.
Going through ugly ideas and trying to then figure out why I was experiencing that. And that, I think, I remember vividly being in that office where several different points I'd had this aha moment. Realizing, this is a morbid thought. But if I'm a God who wants my children to learn how to do hard things and to be able to console each other on hard things, I need them to learn these experiences.
Yeah.
Not for themselves, so they can help each other. They can help someone else.
Yeah.
And that's that cognitive spiritual therapy.
That's a savior-like principle, right?
Yes.
I'm not saying you yourself are the savior, but just...
No, but if I'm trying to be...
If you're trying to... Yeah, that is a very... savior-like quality.
Which, in my own mind, I don't think I'd ever, after reading things... like
we never looked through that through the lens of suffering.
Correct.
You always think like you're going to be like the savior.
Giving high fives.
Just happy, bringing your buddy to church and they have the best experience ever.
Your Santa Claus savior.
Yeah, yeah. That's not... This was a whole new Jesus that we met, genuinely.
And one that you could appreciate even if you were suicidal.
Oh, totally.
Especially if you were suicidal.
I was
going to
say even probably more so.
Like that Jesus makes way more sense if you've been through suffering. And having researched, having gone, I'm reading a lot of church biblical stuff, having never looked through that lens, I didn't realize that people had actually taught this way. Because when you would read C.S. Lewis, you wouldn't necessarily see this in his writings because you're not looking for it.
Well, you weren't. Your eyes weren't open.
But once having that experience, all of a sudden I would look at some of these teachings and realize this actually is a person who loves God and sees this despite the pain, still wants to be like him and is trying to teach everybody else about it in a very unique way, but you can't see it because you don't know the code.
Yes.
It's like speaking in a parable and you don't have the code.
Well, that's what the Savior did, taught in parables.
Correct.
So you got to work for it to understand it.
Through 2019, generally just developed
gradual improvements,
physiologically taking supplements. And then at one point in time, agreeing with my doctor, okay, let's try and go back onto
detox long enough.
Let's try and go back on antidepressants and see if they'll work.
And it wasn't that we were anti-medicine.
No.
We just knew your body, well, it was so resistant to everything. It needed a full detox.
Which is good. So I'd been off antidepressants for about a year at this point. And I had taken Prozac previously. So it's not that I had not had experience with this particular medication. Mm-hmm. In 2018, in May, I tried that at the maximum dose. Touch anything.
Didn't do anything. So, but once you detoxed.
Once I detoxed.
And that you got your other chemical systems working again.
Correct. It fed my body with the nutrients that it needed.
And I will say that you started to eat differently a little bit. You weren't fanatic. And you definitely were trying to move your body. Again, not fanatic, very baby step. But it was a multifaceted.
That's a good point. That for myself, as far as moving my body and exercise, historically I'd been a soccer player, but I hated running.
Yeah. You didn't run. This is when you started moving your body again.
So at this point in time, I'd never actually really lifted weights before in my life. I'd had a friend during this time frame who had tried to train me on it a little bit, but I was socially resistant.
Slightly.
And I hated going to socially. I just hate being around people, especially if I look stupid. So I didn't want to go to the gym. So we bought just a bunch of dumbbells.
We made a little home gym.
Home gym. And at that point in time, it was as if I
found a good workout program I was doing too.
Correct.
And I said, try this.
That was something that you would actually look forward to. And you're like, I have to find something that will fit Todd's personality.
He's not going to go do a ton of cardio. He's not. So I tried a bunch of different programs and I found one, and it was quick, 30 to 40 minutes.
I don't have to be around anybody else.
Yeah. And I knew you wouldn't do it if it was much longer than that.
It's not Zumba.
I knew you weren't doing Zumba.
It was a good call.
And I knew you weren't going to high fitness.
Sorry. So that was good. That actually was another, of the 10 buckets that you have to fill up when you're 10, 20, 50 bucks that you have to fill up to be able to feel good when you're struggling emotionally, that was one of those buckets that I needed to fill. Mm-hmm. And that type of workout gelled with me.
Yeah. Yeah, you've been consistent with that ever since.
So in August of 2019, I started gradually taking Prozac. And we increased the dosage every month. And it was November.
I was going to say it was November.
It was November 2019, where a week after I had upped my dosage, I remember driving to work and being like, "Oh, that's weird.
I don't want to hurt everyone in my path." That's weird. I don't hope I'm getting in a car wreck on my way to work.
And some of the employees that I'd worked with at work had not known me before my crash.
Oh, I know. Isn't that crazy?
Several of them had.
They only knew crazy crashed, Todd.
Some of them had only been hired like summer of 2018. So they had only known this guy that just came into the office, didn't talk to anybody. Yeah. Said there's teeth in kids' mouths, and then would walk out.
I think about that with some of our friends now. I'm like, you didn't know us before crash. You only met us during crash. We are totally different people. You don't even know us.
Why is Todd always a jerk? Has he always been that way? No. But I remember some of my employees saying to me, like, why are you talking to people now?
Why are you talking to us?
What happened?
Why do you know we exist except to deposit a check in our bank account? Not that you were ever a crappy boss. You always tried your hardest to be, but
For me,
you just weren't social.
Like to start having conversations.
It probably made him scared. Why is he talking to us? Why is Dr. Bagley out here? Do you like to talk to that mom? Is he on something?
that's not prescribed.
Things are going to get crazy.
Yeah.
And I started to try and explain. This was a moment where I started to try and explain some of my ideas as well to people that were close to me. Like my family came down for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, they weren't. Yeah, they didn't. They weren't very receptive because it's foreign concepts.
It is a foreign concept. And my delivery was horrible.
Yeah.
December, I think December in my own mind of 2019 was like the turning point. In fact, it was a Saturday-Sunday combination and kind of the week prior. So in that week prior, that Saturday, we'd actually gone to a social Christmas party.
Is this when I just had surgery on my hand too? Was that time frame?
That was previous.
Okay.
No, yeah, it was probably a couple months before.
Okay.
You had surgery on your hand.
Okay.
There's that. And you had broken your foot somewhere in this time frame too. It was so cool.
It was a hell of a couple years. Heck of a couple years.
It's a hell. So there's this week, we're actually going to a white elephant party, which is like my absolute.
Oh, your absolute demise. I was so scared to go. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Not for me. I wanted to go.
It's a social.
It was all my friends.
Social Christmas party.
Yeah.
And like my nightmare under any other normal situation. But for some reason, because I'm starting to feel the effects.
The meds are kicking in. Like, he gets so excited about this. You got so excited about this gift.
Well, it was just a gift. That's all.
Yeah, you just thought it would. You just wanted the funniest gift.
I'm like, if I have to have like a Todd is back kind of a moment.
You were cut. It was like your coming out party.
Coming out
or not
of
coming
insanity.
Out party.
Coming out of the crazy.
Yes, like you're.
I'm coming out of the crazy, the madness.
Yeah, the socialites. They have a coming out party, right?
Yeah. I want to talk about the gift, but I'm not quite sure I'd give it the oomph that it would.
Okay, so he gets obsessive about this thing, and he tries to get this funny gift, and I'm sitting there watching like. He has had more motivation over this dang white elephant gift than I have seen in like years. Anyway, so he comes up with this funny idea, gives this gift. Everybody laughed. I remember thinking, oh, we may have made it. I never think anything's going to be perfect. I don't still think it is. I still think there's crashes that will come.
Yeah.
But I do remember thinking, one, we're at this party. So our good friends that always throw a white elephant and invite us despite all of our rejections every year, keep inviting us. We go and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, we may have made it. We may have made it. And then it just got better.
Do you remember the next day?
No. What was it?
And your parents are there with us. Your parents are in.
My poor parents are always just stuck with us.
No, this was unique. I mean,
okay.
Because they... It was Christmas time.
Yeah.
It was Sunday.
Okay.
And the only time I play my cello historically has been around Christmas.
Christmas.
And I'd not really played it the last couple of years because
it was too hard.
And there was so in 2017 my mom had contracted cancer. And one of those Thanksgivings that she had come down on an electric piano, she had recorded with me. She had recorded her accompaniment to some cello songs. Mm-hmm. And one was a Christmas song, O Come Emmanuel. Mm-hmm. And while I was, one of the things that actually did also help me while I was struggling was to play the cello.
Yeah,
and I hadn't pulled out like that for 20 years.
Yeah, you had not been that consistent with it. It was another thing that stimulated your brain.
So on this particular Sunday, I was asked to play the cello. And I opted to play O Come Emmanuel. We're with our congregation who knows exactly, who has watched us go through this madness the 2 years
we
before.
Weren't shy about it.
We weren't.
Yeah.
And so many people loved me, but knew how untouchable I was socially. Mm-hmm. I just did not want to.
Yourself out there anyway.
So this was like the one way that I could express my appreciation for them. And it was this huge payoff. I remember being in the middle of playing and just bawling.
I remember that too, now that you say that. Yeah.
And my good friend who was also sitting on the stand, like just you said you were seeing Jed just bawling.
Yeah, it was emotional.
because Jed had helped out with several things during those,
yeah,
those 2 years. And playing in a way that's even practicing, I've not played like that before. I came off of the stand and you said that was different.
Yeah. Oh, there was some emotion that came out in that playing for sure that was tangible on the strings.
And then I did have an accompanist. It wasn't my mom that was playing, and it wasn't the recording that she had made. But I remember just being so appreciative for my mom and for the suffering that she had continued to endure at that point in time, as far as her cancer was concerned. But just like you do when you're a little kid, it was one of those moments where, like, I want my mom.
Totally,
I want my mom here.
I know.
It was transformational.
Well, and you revert to childlike innocence, right? I think that's often what happens a lot. And that's very childlike, wanting your mom. It's not a negative thing.
So I called my mom and I just said, hey, I wanted to let you know that I played this.
I'm back, baby.
My mom and I had shared some really unique experiences because we had both gone through some
really hard things,
dark things during those time frames, that she was one of the only people I could share them with and she could understand. And so it was a big payoff to come home from that cello performance at church and tell my mom what had happened and say that I feel like things are getting better.
Better. And your mom was one of the only ones that could tell you what to do. And you would listen.
Sometimes.
Well, I just remember during those dark times, her calling and saying, I've had this impression, get the guns out of your house. And we did it immediately.
Yes.
Yeah. We've since lost your mom. She passed away.
Yeah.
This last August. Miss her.
One of the hardest things was trying to pull out the cello.
I know. And we always listen to her accompanies or her recordings. It chokes us all up.
Anyway, that was Christmas of 2019. Getting ready to enter into 2020. And at this point in time, we'll close off this episode because it's getting long.
Mm-hmm. It's getting long. It's getting late.
And the next episode, we'll come back and kind of talk about how the revelations that we got from those 2 years, 2018 and 2019, then became amazing assets.
Now we understand the meaning of the years, the crash.
The purpose of the pain. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.